Hey everybody, this is the fourth episode of the Syracuse Startup Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Long from the Long Law Firm. Syracuse Startup is a showcase for some of the startups and businesses in and around Syracuse, where each episode we take someone who's local to Syracuse, who's either worked to build their own business, or who has connections in the startup community in Syracuse, and we talk to them about what's good in the hood. In this episode, I interviewed Dr. Jamie Winders. Dr. Winders is the director of the Autonomous Systems Vehicle Policy Institute at Syracuse University, where her research focuses on the design, regulation, and social impacts of emerging technologies, particularly autonomous systems and artificial intelligence. And I found this episode really interesting, especially if, like me, you're thinking about how the development of drone and autonomous vehicle technology affects policy and culture. Dr. Winders is extremely accessible, and she has a real gift for breaking down complex subject matter into easy-to-understand concepts. So I really enjoyed talking to her today. If you have any questions for future podcasts, shoot me an email at jlong@long.law. That's jlong@long.law. In case you don't know, or this is your first time listening, when I'm not hosting podcasts, I'm an attorney in downtown Syracuse, and I'm the managing attorney of the Long Law Firm, which is a small business and startup boutique law firm, and we are Syracuse's premier firm for data privacy and cybersecurity law. If you'd like to check us out, we're easy to find. We're on the internet at long.law, where you can actually make a virtual appointment with us for a free consultation. We're on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and you can feel free to reach out on any of those venues and say hello. Also, if you like the podcast, please consider leaving a positive review wherever you download your podcasts. It really helps get the word out. So I'd like to keep this relatively short, but I've got a couple of disclaimers, and then we can talk to Dr. Winders. So first off, there's nothing on this podcast that is legal advice to you. There are a lot of good lawyers out there. I happen to be one of them. But if you do have a legal issue, you should talk to an attorney. You should talk to somebody and not rely on anything that you've heard on this podcast or frankly, any other podcast. Last, in some jurisdictions, I may have to disclose this podcast as attorney advertising. So there, I just did. Thanks. All right, so it's official. I have my friend Jamie Winders here from Syracuse University, and this is the fourth episode of Syracuse Startup. So Jamie, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So my name's Jamie Winders. I'm a professor of geography in the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. And I also direct the Autonomous Systems Policy Institute, which is a new institute at Syracuse University, and we affectionately call it ASPE.
And what does ASPE do?
So ASPE focuses on, if you close your eyes and you think about a Venn diagram, it focuses on the kind of design, policy, and societal impacts of autonomous systems. And our goal is to put the teaching and the research that we do at that center of the Venn diagram, where questions of how autonomous systems get designed, how they're structured, what kind of systems support their use, overlap with the questions about how best to regulate and manage the use of autonomous systems, and where those two things then overlap with the really big set of questions about how autonomous systems, from driverless vehicles to unmanned aerial vehicles or drones or things that go on the water, things that go under the water, how they'll impact society in all sorts of ways. And so we try to take that 360 view of how these emerging technologies impact the world around us, and then the kind of normative question about how should they.
Right. And so does that work involve interaction with actual drones, with actual builders and actual founders?
So we have a bunch of different stakeholders or groups that are involved with ASPE. And so we have a large group of faculty at Syracuse University who study some aspect of autonomous systems. And so some of them, especially faculty in our School of Engineering, do very hands-on design with drones in particular. So thinking about how can we improve the way they land when maybe they've lost their kind of GPS link. A lot of research on the sensors, on basically what you might call how these autonomous systems see and comprehend the world around them. So a lot of that work is very hands-on with actual drones in their laboratories. But then you also have faculty who are interested in the kind of surveillance and privacy questions that the application of autonomous systems raise. And so there, you know, you might have faculty in our law school or in our policy school whose offices aren't filled with the different parts that go together to make, you know, a drone or a driverless vehicle, but they're thinking about kind of the legal framework that wraps around them. We also have a strong connection to industry stakeholders and have a lot of conversations with everything from brand new startups to some of the large corporations and players in each of the different domains of autonomous systems. Because one of the things that's really important when you study something that's both this new and also that changes this quickly is that there's always that two-way conversation between what sort of academic research on this overall topic is showing and what are the trends and developments in industry, what are the pressing questions that they have, where are the areas that they would like more information, and then also with all of the different groups and communities that are impacted by the adoption or again the application of these technologies. So we try to keep all of those lines of communications open as we think about how best to study and also how to teach our students about this emerging field.
Okay, so that sounds like you're in the herding cats business.
Yes, that's a great analogy. It's a great, you know, because the other thing is, so in another part of my life, my research, I study international migration.
Okay.
So if I wanted to stand up an institute on the study of international migration, I might look at 10 or 11 disciplines from law to policy to the humanities to the social sciences that study this. I'd have a pretty good sense of who are the key players in terms of policy, so who would be the folks involved at the federal level, what are some of the state level issues related to an immigrant presence. You kind of know who the key players are.
Yeah.
Because we've spent centuries studying this phenomenon of international migration.
Right.
When you talk about something like autonomous systems and artificial intelligence, it's a brand new field. There's not a single academic discipline that, quote, owns it. There's a component of the impacts of these systems in nearly every discipline on a college campus. And when you think about what it looks like in the context of industry and innovation, that's also spread not only across these different domains of autonomy, so things that drive, things that fly, things that are on water, things, autonomous systems that are immobile. So it's a very kind of siloed, and so is the regulatory framework. So it's kind of a hot mess.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because, you know, you think about, okay, things that fly, things that drive, things that swim, for lack of a better word, right? And then, but you also have within the same device, things that fly, things that listen, things
right.
that watch, things that feel, right? So it's multidisciplinary in that sense.
Oh, too, yeah. Right? And then you also have what's the infrastructure that's required for these systems to be able to work. Right.
Right.
So drone, to fly your drone, it has to be connected to something, right?
Right.
For us to be able to fly drones in mass, those drones have to be visible to someone or something that is keeping track of where they all are. For a driverless vehicle, not only do you have to have the sensors on the vehicle, but in an ideal world, and this is where a lot of people hope we're heading, that vehicle needs to be able to communicate with other vehicles on the road to know if there's a hazard ahead, if something's coming, are the road conditions changing? And in some cases, that vehicle needs to be able to communicate with the actual infrastructure of the road.
Right.
You know, and so again, it's the complication of the actual machines and and the systems that allow them to move and navigate the world, but it's also this wraparound infrastructure. So it's a very, trying to get your head around all these different facets really requires this interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary, really complicated framework that involves everything from engineers to architects to folks in public communications to thinking about what might have to change in K-12 education if the world we're moving toward is going to have more and more of these autonomous systems, more and more incorporation of AI. How does that change the way we teach our kids?
Right. Yeah. And then of course the thing that, you know, we talked about privacy.
It's huge.
Cybersecurity.
It's huge,
and, And that's, that's a field that is changing so rapidly as well that, the autonomous vehicle field and, if you want to call it that, and the privacy field, in some ways have already collided, and in some ways I think are sort of due for, an even bigger collision, right? Because you've got the law in New York changed recently that, biometric data is considered, personal information. And you've got these things flying around that are filming faces.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, when founders think about, building a company that's based on drone technology, one of the things that they'll learn pretty quickly is, you got to blur those faces out right away. Right. I mean, that's something that's kind of standard now. But that someone who's maybe just getting started in the field, into a wide open field when there's really not a huge barrier to entry, hasn't really fully thought through yet.
Well, and you get some really interesting, and if you look at in the realm of drones, some really interesting competing understandings of this idea of privacy.
Right.
So at the moment, if a small drone, if we see it appear outside your window, we don't actually have any way of knowing who is controlling that drone. If we bring it down, assuming that its controller and owner has registered with the FAA, we might be able to know who owns that drone, but we don't at the moment have a system for what's called remote identification. We're moving toward that, but we don't have it right now.
Right.
Around the push for remote ID, which is something we're headed toward, a lot of drone pilots are now very concerned about their privacy as a drone pilot, right? This question of should anyone and everyone be able to know whose drone that is. And of course, the argument is if you see cars driving up and down the street, you may not know who's driving them. On the flip side of this, there's what you mentioned before, what you might call the bystander effect of, do I have a right to privacy in my backyard? Do I have a right to privacy in a public park? Should someone be able to fly a drone over my house? Should they be able to fly near me or over me at a public park? So you have these two different understandings of whose privacy matters when we talk about something like drones.
Well, do you think they have to compete?
I don't think they have to compete, but at the moment, they're kind of being mobilized in very different ways. So the conversation around remote ID has raised this issue of privacy from pilots' perspectives, whereas there's also this question of the public's right to privacy and in different places, and it differs from state to state.
Yeah.
And that's also where you get this really interesting divide in terms of policy, right? So the FAA controls anything that flies. That's their domain. The FAA's number one driving factor is safety. That's what they're really concerned about, and that is what nearly all of their regulations address, is this issue of safety. When you get down to the state and local levels, if you're a mayor or you're a city manager, what you're hearing about drones is not that people think they're necessarily unsafe. It's, I saw one flying over my pool, or I saw one in my neighborhood, and I want to know who's flying it, and do they have the right to video me? So you've got this federal level thinking about safety, and then you have where the rubber meets the road at the local level, being concerned about privacy. And so you get, it's complicated.
It is complicated. It's, it never occurred to me to care about the privacy of the pilot.
Yeah.
That's just not something that I've ever really thought that much about. That's really interesting. It reminds me, there's hopefully there's somebody out there that's figuring out a way for me to point my phone at a drone and they can tell me at least where it came from or something about it. I mean, I think the car analogy is really interesting, right? Because I think when we talk about technology and when we think about technology, there's so many decision makers that are really, they really struggle to make decisions that understand the technology, right? We saw this, you know, in the 90s with, you know, Congress trying to make laws about the internet. 30 years later, they still haven't really, senators still don't seem to be checking their own email. Like it's you know, and you know, all of the technology that has happened since then, you know, we're still, and they were just talking about this last week or a few weeks ago, right? Where they had Zuckerberg in Congress and, you know, the senators don't really know how Facebook works and Mark Zuckerberg is not eager to tell them, you know, nor should he.
Yeah.
You know, it's on them to, you know, maybe spend the weekend with their teenage child and like figure it out. By the way, like I don't even think teenagers are on Facebook anymore.
No, they migrated a few years ago.
They're like three or four migrations away now. Like, yeah. But it's an interesting problem because I always feel like when you're thinking about these problems, I find it helpful to create analogies into things that people do understand.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, when people first started talking about the internet is a send and a receive. I send you a message, and you receive it, and you send me a response, which is your web page, right? So my computer says, I want to see your web page, and you receive the message, and your computer sends the web page, and then I receive that message. You know, there's no magic to it. And the law largely misses the mark in understanding how that stuff works because of the people who are really in charge are not me, right? And they're not you.
Well, and this is where particularly, just to stay for the moment in the realm of sort of unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs or drones or whatever, the smaller ones, whatever you want to call it, one of the things that the proliferation of drones does is it really shows the value, at least for me, of looking across these different domains, which is it's a foundational element of ASPE, but it's something that we really don't see anywhere else. We're the only institute that's looking across these different domains of autonomy. So if you take drones, which again, it's under the purview of the FAA, which controls anything that flies. And so the frame of reference first to think about drones is obviously manned aircraft. So that's right. What the FAA knows. And drones have entered into that system through the regulations for hobbyists, people who built model airplanes and flew them. Because when drones really began to hit the market and be in the hands of private citizens and people in the U.S., they seemed most like this area of hobbyists.
Sure, which had been around for a long time.
Long time. But, you know, the analogy between drones and planes really starts to fall apart when you begin to think about things like, I have never lent my plane to a friend for the weekend. I've never pulled my plane out of my garage and waxed it and put it back. I've never accidentally backed into somebody's plane, right? Because if you think about manned aircrafts, the barriers to entry are huge. You have to go to school for ages. It's very expensive. There are very, very few places where I could just go and rent a plane for the weekend.
Right.
And so being able to get into that, be in the in crowd of people who can fly a plane, it's a very small group. They're all committed to the same safety rules. It's a highly, highly regulated population.
Right.
I can go right now to Best Buy and I can buy three or four drones. I can buy one drone and in a very short time I can have it in the air without having gone through any training, without having done anything. And that is a fundamentally different relationship between the user and the technology. It's much more akin to cars, where technically you can drive a car without training. You might not do it very well and you might get pulled over, but you know, there aren't security guards sitting around cars the way that you would have for planes. And so when you start to think about drones in relation to planes, the stronger analogy is really personally owned cars. In terms of the number of people who now have access to this technology, the very, very low barriers to entry. And so treating the people who are going to be engaging with small drones the same way you treat pilots who are going to fly large aircraft, it just doesn't hold. Yeah. We have to start thinking outside the box in terms of how we approach these technologies.
Yeah, there's a, well, that's really interesting. So there's a, I think there's a couple of things to unpack there. One, I mean, I had a conversation with somebody a long time ago, and you know, we'll not use any names to protect the innocent, right? But I was at a, you know, a networking event, and at the time, it was, you know, it was at the time where they had this policy with drones that if you wanted to use a commercial drone, you had to get this license. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, you paid a fee. It was a little bit of paperwork, but it was a pretty, it wasn't really a onerous requirement. I think they've since changed that rule in terms of what exactly you had to do, but there was something.
Yeah, it's still the same to get your commercial license.
Yeah, this is something they were doing 5 years ago where it was relatively easy. And I was, you know, as an attorney, I was looking into, you know, building a practice that helps people get these licenses, right? And thinking of it at, you know, kind of the way that you would, you know, it would be a flat fee kind of, you know, I don't know, it was $500 or something right? Where it was just somebody who's not comfortable sending the FAA paperwork. And I remember, you know, because I know a lot of people in the legal industry, I remember thinking like, well, I know that there are private investigators that use this stuff. And so I was at a, you know, I was at like a holiday party or something, and I was talking to this gentleman, and he's a private investigator, and he was bragging to somebody about how, you know, he does all this work with drones. And I said, well, you know, if you're using your drones for a commercial use, I mean, you're actually required to get these licenses. And, you know, by the way, like, I can help you do that really, really easily. And he basically said, well, you know what? I'm going to pass because no one is enforcing this. Yeah. He's like, I've never heard of this. No one's stopping me. I can go to the store and buy a drone. And it's interesting because, I mean, you can't go to the store and buy a car. You can't go to the store and buy a plane. And so that barrier to entry is almost unprecedented in a way.
Yeah. Which raises all sorts of questions and about, and this gets back to thinking why it's important to think about public perception, user perception, societal impacts, these things that are often kind of off the radar when we talk about these emerging technologies. So to go use the example of a car, when you purchase a car, most of us understand that you cannot drive it off the lot without proof of insurance. We're just kind of socialized
right,
into that,
yeah.
That you must go and get a license before you can legally drive a car. These are just things.
You have an expectation of regulation.
Right. That we've just,
with cars.
We're all kind of collectively socialized into that, at least in a U.S. context. And we recognize it as a vehicle, right? That's how we recognize it.
Right.
A drone you can buy at Best Buy. It's probably not that far from washing machines. And it kind of looks like a toy, the smaller ones. So right. There's a question of what does the consumer think this thing that they're unboxing is? Do they view it as a manned, as an unmanned aircraft that falls under the same overall regulatory framework as a plane, or is it seen much more as a toy?
Yeah.
Or as something like my phone, right? Oh, I'm going to get this drone. It will let me take some crazy pictures. That will be awesome. Or it will let me see my neighborhood. Or maybe I'm a real estate agent and I can take video.
Sure.
You know, is it being understood in the same way as a vehicle? And of course, we know it's not. And so then the question becomes, if we're going to treat it as a regulated vehicle of sorts, what public education has to go in? How do you start to socialize people to see this as a vehicle in the same way that they might see a car? And that's what we just don't yet have.
Right.
It's what you just pointed out. I'm like, oh, no, nobody's going to arrest me if I don't do this. No one said anything to me yet, so
I don't think it's really taken seriously. I think there's some awareness, and certainly, because I've never had a really nice drone, but I've certainly had, you know, kind of those, you know, the kind that you might get in a Best Buy for $100, mm-hmm. just I live in farm country and I can,
fly
it around relatively risk-free in terms of hitting anything, right? That's maybe a different proposition than like, you know, the alley next to our office, which is certainly going to bump into something and, you know, cause problems. I mean, it's also an interesting thing because I think that so we try to analogize what are drones really like? And it does, in a way, it does kind of bring you back to the airplane model though, right? Because you think about, well, maybe there needs to be regulation because people are at risk of physical harm. You know, people are at risk of the drone falling out of the sky and landing on them. And they say, okay, well, isn't that true of model airplanes though? Isn't that true of Frisbees? I don't know. I mean, you start to think about, isn't that true of boomerangs? Like we don't regulate boomerangs. We don't regulate lacrosse balls, although in upstate New York, you know,
they can be deadly.
People can throw lacrosse balls 100 yards with with the right stick.
Yeah.
Right? And so it almost starts to beg the question, is part of the issue in the changing of policy not just that there's new technology, but it's the adoption of that technology on a grand scale.
Yeah.
Right? It's the difference, but it's just like when we think about our phones, right? Where one of the big differences between the camera phone now and the camera of the past is that we didn't all have cameras on our person at all times with unlimited storage. You know? So part of it is that, you know, nowadays anyone could walk into a school bathroom with a camera. Well, that was always true before, but you didn't have 300 million cameras walking around, and now you do. Right?
And that scale is really is one of the most challenging kind of regulatory issues when you talk about drones. The small, the under 55 pounds, the ones that your everyday person might go out and buy, they're on a scale that is very, very different from just the number of manned aircraft in the U.S. They're much more readily available. There's so many more of them, and they're in the hands of a new portion of the population that is not kind of socialized and educated about how to behave in airspace. And that, you know, we're at the very beginning of the emergence of this industry, and so we're in the growing pains part of it, of figuring out, well, how do you just create a hard stop so you can't, you just mandate that you will not be able to fly a drone until you take a test and you demonstrate knowledge, until you register it. Do you leave it more in the hands of the consumer and try to encourage more of a soft request? You know, where's that balance? And again, this is the question, and this is the issue when you talk about the relationship between technology and policy. Do you want a situation where policy potentially inhibits technological innovation? Okay, no. So we pretty much think that's a bad idea. At the same time, do you want a situation where technological innovations far outpace the policy frameworks that guide their use? Well, that's bad as well. So then how do you think about what you might call a flexible policy? For example, right now we're talking about drone pilots, drone operators. The term is autonomous. So where we are headed, we hope, or we think in terms of these industries, is more and more pulling the human out of the loop.
Right.
So if we create a whole regulatory framework for how unmanned aerial vehicles, how drones can be operated by a pilot, what happens when that pilot's role is less and less? Can we create a policy framework that can adjust to that moment down the road? Or do we have something now that's going to create even more headaches down the road when we reach a situation where it's more feasible to do swarms, where maybe one person is controlling multiple drones that are evaluating crops or inspecting power lines or something like that? Do we have a policy framework that can allow that innovation? That's the challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the policy side, there's a real burden to get it right.
Right.
Or at least kind of right. Because while I'm not a big fan of regulation generally, just like I think you know, a lot of business lawyers are not fans of regulation generally, even though it's a lot of what we spend our time doing.
It keeps you in business.
It keeps us in business, but, you know, in terms of serving our clients, it's you know, it's a burden, right? But I think the risk is that when things are completely unregulated or they are underregulated, what we have is, you know, the Gilded Age. And the Gilded Age is bad not just for, you know, the disparate outcomes that it generates, you know, and one could argue that that's true now too, but also there's going to be a pendulum swing. There's going to be that reaction point. And if your pendulum is way too far in one direction, what you're going to get is overregulation in response. Because, you know, if something is underregulated and you have, you know, some sort of national tragedy, all of a sudden those senators that can't even check their email are going to start making rules that really don't make sense, right? They really don't understand what's actually at play.
Well, and the other concern, and you see this in the realm of autonomous vehicles, driverless vehicles as well, is so again, with the example of drones, the FAA has plenary power, so they get to make the rules for things that fly. But what we're seeing is at the local or municipality level, as well as sometimes at the state level, states and localities also attempting to manage how and where drones can be used. And so the concern there is that you could end up with this sort of patchwork landscape at the state and local level. And again, we see it in the realm of autonomous vehicles, where some states are really kind of leading the charge in terms of trying to create state-level laws that enable the use of autonomous vehicles on their road, whereas others aren't. And so I think it's New Hampshire that recently just sprinted ahead of everyone to try to create a state-level legislative framework that would allow basically air taxis. Okay. Now, we don't have them. These have not been brought to market yet. But you can see they're kind of anticipating this. And you can see this in some other states. You know, Michigan is in the process of designating a 40-mile... basically a test corridor for autonomous vehicles. So they're trying to create the legislative framework to enable that, because it's a form of innovation that they see as bringing jobs, as they see it as something good, whereas other states are much further behind the curve in terms of thinking about whether their state laws would actually allow driverless vehicles. So there's some states that have requirements of the driver must have two hands on the wheel. Well, if it's a truly driverless vehicle, you don't have a driver, and B, you may not have a steering wheel. So in that situation, you know, something would have to change about that state law.
Yeah.
And so from the perspective of industry, what they do not want is a situation where the rules governing the use of these different autonomous systems change every time, you know, you cross a state line.
Right, right. Because I would assume that at some point the goal is to further travel, you know, so that you can Uber to California for the weekend, and it should be a relatively easy thing to do, right?
It's interesting to think about what really is the end goal of this, the industries developing around autonomous systems or AVs, because if you go back even just 2 years ago, the predictions were very, very optimistic that within a couple of years, truly autonomous vehicles will be on the road around us. We'll see them. We're just on this very rapid pace to full adoption.
Yeah, we've been waiting for our Amazon packages to be dropped to us for years now, right?
You know, and then kind of in 2019, particularly in the realm of AVs, they really pumped the brakes on that, because they began to realize that making those first steps toward an autonomous vehicle can be done relatively quickly. But it's that last portion to figure out, you know, so if you're driving and I'm trying to cross the street and I'm thinking about it, you're reading my body language, and without even thinking about it, in terms of tacit knowledge, you're deciding, is she going to walk in front of me or is she not going? And you might even gun it a little bit to warn me that you see me and you can tell that I'm thinking about that. So all this back and forth is going on and you aren't even aware that you're making these decisions.
Right.
Teaching an autonomous vehicle to do that kind of intellectual work is really, really difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I've also heard it explained as teaching the machine to create the lesser tragedy too,
yeah.
Right? Where you have, you know, you could imagine, you know, an urban setting, someone is attempting to avoid
the
a fender bender,
dilemma,
and
yeah.
they drive into, you know, a crowded sidewalk,
yeah.
right? And that's, as soon as a computer does that, they're, it's going to put this technology back, you know, 5-10 years.
Well, and there you also, this is again is the complexity that is about encoding cultural norms into an AI system,
yeah.
right? Because the rules, if you know, the classic choice is if the choice is to hit a mother with a child in a stroller or an 80-year-old elderly couple. If you have to hit one of the two, which ones do you hit? It's the classic trolley dilemma. The answer to that question is not going to be the same worldwide, right? So there are going to be places where
yeah.
the life, where elder life is so highly valued that the choice would be, you know, hit the kid and the mom. Other places...
I got to make sure I retire there, wherever that is. That's where I'm going.
But the other thing, you know, when we have this conversation, we often treat it as if all the machine, all the AV has to do is learn human behavior, as if that human behavior is static. But close your eyes and envision autonomous vehicles in New York City. And
oh,
they're
yeah,
going to be
absolutely.
Trained. They will be programmed to, anytime someone steps in front of the car, you stop. It will take New Yorkers about 25 minutes to realize that if they want to cross the road, all they have to do is walk into the road and all the AVs will stop. That will bring traffic to a screeching halt.
For
so
sure.
What's the solution there? Do you increase the police force and you ticket people? Do you program the cars so that they hit every 1,000th? Like what's that threshold that will keep your average New Yorker from stepping in front of these cars? And so our behaviors as humans will change when we start to see more and more AVs hit the road. So that interaction between machine and human isn't static. So it will be a
yeah.
constant calibration.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I grew up right outside of New York City. I grew up about an hour west in Jersey. And yeah, I mean, the way that people drive here in Syracuse is not the way that I was raised to drive. And that's not the way that, you know, people in that area drive. Just not just sitting at the intersections, but just those decisions about letting someone go versus not letting someone
exactly.
go.
Exactly.
You know, and interestingly, in other parts of the country, it's not even necessarily rural versus urban, right? Which makes the decision-making process more difficult. Like, if you drive in San Francisco, people are getting out of your way constantly. I don't understand how they get anywhere. They're like, you know, whereas in New York or even in LA, people are shooting in front of you all the time. That's just, you know, four places we talked about that it'd be hard to really figure out what
yeah.
is, you know, and then what happens when you bring your vehicle somewhere else. And that's a really interesting problem. But so actually, I want to kind of turn the conversation around because this is fascinating, but I want to turn it towards Syracuse.
Ah, yes.
And talk about that a little bit. So tell me a little bit, first of all, about what's going on with autonomous vehicles in Syracuse, you know, from your perspective. Like what is the scene that you're seeing?
So Syracuse is a really interesting site for innovation around autonomous systems, especially UAVs or drones. And so this part of central New York historically had strong connections to an Air Force base and had the development of a very robust kind of aerospace industry, building all the different sensors and all the different kind of programs that would enable flight in all sorts of ways. And when that Air Force base was decommissioned, you still had this footprint or this legacy of strength in aerospace. And that kind of historical context has now given birth to this what a lot of people call kind of the drone ecosystem. So Syracuse has one of seven FAA drone corridors for testing, so it's a relatively unique site.
So tell
in
people
the US.
What that means if they don't know what that means.
So there's a 50-mile. So the FAA, when the drone industry really started taking off, the FAA designated seven sites throughout the country as places where drone technology could be tested. Because at the beginning of the emergence of the kind of commercial drone industry. We know that drones have had a very strong military presence for a long time, but when that military technology really started to enter the commercial realm and new companies started to get involved, the FAA wanted to designate places where people could go and test, as opposed to just test wherever you want and hope for the best.
Right.
And so Central New York, some of those original players involved in kind of engineering and aerospace in this area got together and put in a proposal, and it was accepted to build out this 50-mile corridor where companies could come and test the drone technology, could do safety certification, can do all sorts of things. So it's kind of an infrastructure for innovation around around drones. They also created a kind of innovative public-private partnership called New Air. I will get that acronym wrong, but it's something about New York and air and unmanned systems. And so New Air plus the corridor has really been the basis for building out, again, what's often called this drone ecosystem. At the same time, the city of Syracuse, in that same general time period, created basically a tech incubator, the Tech Garden, where they bring in small companies that are something to do with innovation, a lot of focus on smart cities, but a lot of those companies have focused on the drone industry. And so there's now this critical mass of people thinking about and working on technological innovations. There's the infrastructure of the drone corridor to do a lot of testing. There's support from the city as well as from the state to sort of stand up these companies. And what we're beginning to see is not only do some of these companies stay, but other companies that are interested in getting into the drone industry are coming here because there's the federal corridor, there's state support, there's local support, and there's this now kind of this critical mass of people thinking about this.
So how are you able to plug the Institute into that sort of burgeoning scene?
So the conversation around ASPE kind of began at the same time that some of these things were developing. Now, I wasn't involved in those early conversations, but ASPE, I think we can sort of think about it in a number of ways. And so one is that the Institute is kind of the policy component of this overall drone ecosystem. So there are business, there's startups, there's the infrastructure for building out the technology, there's support for all of that. And then ASPE brings to this mix a focus on the policy implications, what might be some best practices in thinking about how the kind of use cases in this industry can be regulated, as well as thinking about what are the ethical questions that accompany all these different use cases. How do we begin to think about the uneven societal impacts we might see with some of these different uses? So I think that's one component. I think the other component is beginning. So there's a research part of ASPE, and then there's also a teaching part. And so this year, we're in the process of putting in an application to offer an interdisciplinary undergraduate major in the study of autonomous systems, as well as a graduate certificate. I think one of our goals is to begin to produce thought leaders in this area. And if you think about the kind of educational initiatives around drones in particular, the primary thing you see is let's teach people how to fly drones, which is a great skill to have. You can find jobs doing that. You can open your own business. But again, on a long enough timeline, these are autonomous systems. And so the whole goal of the development of these technologies is to pull the human out of the loop. Right. And so just teaching people how to fly the drones from our perspective isn't enough. What we want to do is produce students who understand the technology, who understand how to think about policy and at all these different levels, and who understand how to think about where's that sweet spot between encouraging innovation and ensuring and creating a policy framework that encourages ethical use, and that can think about the societal impacts. And so ASPE there, I think, can also be some talent development for this overall ecosystem and encourage graduates from Syracuse University to stay in this area.
Nice. So if somebody, say there's somebody who's interested
in getting involved in the drone industry, whether it's, you know, either as an entrepreneur, which is, you know, what I tend to be more focused on, or as a as an engineer or as a thought leader just in general. Mm-hmm. So if they wanted to do that in Syracuse, what would you recommend, you know, they plug into, and what would you recommend they do to take those steps?
That's a really good question. So what you what's missing, and what you just hit the nail on, is sort of a more formalized network of people in this industry, sort of a business association or a professional association at the scale of Syracuse. Now, there are certainly professional associations that people could join. So there's AUVSI, which is kind of the, wanting to see itself as the industry leader in all things autonomous. And so they hold a lot of events, most of which are all virtual right now, some of which are free. So that at kind of a national scale, that would be a way to get involved. But thinking about how to get involved here, I mean, I think one of the things they could do to certainly learn more about autonomous systems, they could go to the ASPE's website. They could reach out to NewAir, which is the public-private partnership that's associated with the Drone Corridor. They could certainly reach out to the folks who organize and run the Tech Garden within the city of Syracuse. I think those would be some kind of local involvement. You know, in terms of learning how to get involved with drones, there's some material from the FAA, but YouTube will become your best friend, because there are fascinating videos out there where people are trying to summarize the latest FAA regulations, talking about all the different use cases. So there's a ton of information out there to kind of give people a sense of how they might incorporate these technologies into whatever they do. But you know, you're right that there really isn't a kind of regional group that pulls together people interested in some aspect of, say, drones. It's just not there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Tech Garden does, you know, the Tech Garden has several people who are in that space, mm-hmm. and in that world, you know, and it's, I think it's tough because a lot of people who are starting businesses, they may be tempted to think, you know, think of those people as their competition.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know, in some sense that may be true, but I think that by getting together, you're going to have more of an opportunity from interacting with other people. I mean, I know Tech Garden actually has a podcast as well. And I think it was their podcast a little while ago had someone on who they had used drones to pollinate apple trees.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you know who I'm talking about?
I know the example, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, that sort of thing. And if somebody is looking to get into that business, I mean, you know, I wish I could remember their name. I would give them a shout out because I thought their company was really cool. But, you know, that would be someone that, you know, if I was looking to found, you know, an autonomous vehicle company or a company that is utilizing this technology, whether autonomously or just unmanned, you know, I would want to talk to those people. So, I mean, I would think that, I don't know, I think Syracuse actually does a really great job of, I don't know if Syracuse, the place necessarily, but just, I think that we have a really interesting community of people that, you know, where else in a small city can you, you know, can you pull a professor who is this steeped in, you know, the policy issues and be able to speak technology and be able to talk about all those things. I mean, we're really in an opportune time and place.
Well, and we're also in a place where no one yet has named and claimed the kind of framework we'll use to talk about these technologies. And I'll give you a classic example. So pre-COVID, I wanted to hold some meet and greets for Syracuse University alums interested in some aspect of autonomous systems. And so we started stepping back and trying to think about how do we go about identifying of the thousands of SU grads, who's working in this area. And I knew some. Some had reached out to me when they heard about ASPE, and I had made connections with some. But even on something like LinkedIn, there's no obvious way. Like, if we wanted to identify who are all the SU alums who are attorneys, we'd know how to search our databases. We'd know how to search LinkedIn.
Right.
And we could pull that list together fairly quickly. But it was a real challenge to start to think about how do we go about identifying people who have some involvement in this nascent industry that hasn't really, like, I use the term autonomous systems to talk about all the systems. Some people do, a lot of them are much more siloed of I do AVs and I do drones and I do maritime. Sometimes we'll call them emerging technologies to kind of link in artificial intelligence as well. But it's the what we're going to call this thing, how we identify people who are in it, that hasn't gelled yet.
Yeah, I thought it was because you just said, you know, if we wanted to find lawyers, we would know how to do that. If we wanted to find, and then you just gave a very long description of what in the other category you just said lawyers, right? So I think that sort of illustrates exactly the challenge, right? I kind of went through that a little bit, you know, when I founded this firm.
Yeah.
And, you know, talking to people about, well, what, you know, what are your practices? What are the practice areas that you work in, you know? And, you know, autonomous vehicles is, you know, frankly, not something that I spend a lot of my time doing, but it's something that I'm working towards being able to do, you know, developing the skill set to be able to service those clients. And, you know, how do you describe that? You know, on the door, you'll see like there's a logo and there's, you know, sort of a list of things that we do, right? I mean, I called it emerging technologies, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, someone else may walk up to that door and logo and say, emerging technologies, what does that mean?
Well, right now we have this amazing SU recent grad and that we've asked. She's in graphic design. She's an amazing artist. And we're working with her to try to develop an image that we can use to illustrate what ASPE does. And it's been really complicated to think about how do you identify, how do you come up with something that will signal these different domains that conveys the idea of autonomy, but also acknowledges that there's always a human involved that gets at that, and it's a chance to, because there's not an obvious icon. Like if we were both interested in nuclear, you know the icon. You just have to put that little thing with all the loops that come together, and everybody sees it and says, oh, that's nuclear.
Yeah.
If you wanted to do the railroads, oh, you know, you just show the tracks. But autonomous systems hasn't been distilled down to this icon that says, oh, I know what that is.
Well, because they haven't really decided yet what they're even going to be, right? I mean, it's funny, you know, when you think, this came up, I was making my website, right? Early in the year, I was working on a website, and I put my phone number up on the website, and I have a little signal against that phone number, and it's a telephone, and it's a box with a headpiece and a little wire.
Oh, so it's not the traditional...
Right. The last time I put something like that next to my head, I was probably 7 years old, right? But we all understand that that's what the symbol is, you know? And I think with drones and with autonomous vehicles, it's unclear, you know, it may be... Like, I think it's easier for lay people to talk about drones, to say drones, to think about drones... Right, but you're in a different space, and you're thinking. Well, a drone isn't exactly what an autonomous vehicle necessarily is. But you know, I mean, I suspect that the drone iconography is going to be something that will last longer than the idea of a person fiddling with a controller will actually be. You know, just like. We no longer see people wearing those funny blue and white hats, but we know that that's a train engineer.
Yeah.
Right.
And those images haven't yet gelled.
Yeah, they haven't solidified yet. That's interesting. So when you said that they hadn't yet, what I thought you were going to say was that no one has yet claimed like a sort of a centerpiece of development in this type of technology, right? So like we talk about, you know, Silicon Valley as the place where software is really the, you know, it's the defining feature of the place, but more importantly, the, you know, when you build some killer software, someone's going to look you in the eye and tell you you should move to Silicon Valley, right? Even though there's plenty of other places like New York, like Austin, you know, that you can do that work. So, yeah, what I thought you were going to say is that there is not really been identified a place that is sort of the center of this economy, of this industry.
Obviously, it's ASPE. We get to be at the
center. Well, that's why I wanted to give you an opportunity.
Obviously, we get to be at the center of that.
To throw your flag into the ground and make and claim that space for Syracuse. That's what I'm trying to set you up for.
Well, and I do think there's real possibility for that. You know, we right now, ASPE is the only research institute that we're aware of anywhere that looks across domains. So everything else that's out there is it's domain specific. So drones, AVs, maritime. And we have an interdisciplinary reach that nobody else has. So if you look at other, and this would be true of a couple of institutes, like Johns Hopkins has one that does look at autonomous systems.
Who?
As a whole. Johns Hopkins.
Never heard of them.
Terrible school. But their focus is very much in engineering. And so most of the institutes out there started either in engineering and then expanded to incorporate maybe another group of researchers, or started in urban and regional planning to think about AVs, but they don't have an engineering component.
Right.
And ASPE was launched, policy is in the title, but its core is where all those fields meet, and it's my job to be the translator among these different fields. And so I do think that gives an opportunity to start to try to identify that core. But in terms of the sites of innovation, you know, that I think is a real challenge. And so there certainly are test beds for AV. So Pittsburgh, Houston, Michigan is really trying to get into the game. With drones, it's a much more diffuse area. So we haven't seen kind of an entire business ecosystem begin to develop around drones. And I think that's where there are real opportunities for Syracuse.
Yeah.
The other thing about Syracuse is we're relatively close to the Canadian border. And so once we get our heads around how to regulate autonomous flying vehicles in a U.S. context, then we have to think about, well, how do they cross the border? And so that, I think, is a real opportunity for innovation here because they're so close, to begin to think about what has to change in the software, what changes in the regulations, how do we begin to think about supply chains and logistics when you can incorporate drones into international kind of commerce, which we just aren't doing at the moment. And, you know, that is an advantage that this FAA corridor will have that the others just won't.
Yeah, I was actually thinking something similar in that one of my favorite things about Syracuse is that you can live in the country and you can work in the city.
Yeah.
And, you know, having grown up in a place where you kind of have to choose one or the other, you know, Syracuse is fantastic where you can live on a dairy farm and within 20 minutes to a half hour be in downtown Syracuse, you know, and because drones occupy physical space, you know, I think that that's an important thing. But one of the other things I wanted to ask you is, because we did, you know, we talked a lot about policy, right? What about policies from the outside looking in to attract business, you know, to attract autonomous vehicle business, to attract drone business to come to Syracuse? I mean, have you guys thought at all about what are the things that could bring those companies, that innovation, that, you know, ecosystem, like you called it, to the city of Syracuse?
So I you know, I think this is certainly something that organizations like New Air, the Tech Garden, has spent a lot of time thinking about. From the perspective of ASPE, you know, one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing is talking with potential industry partners. So everything from very small startups to very large companies who hear about what we're doing, and they want to try to get a sense of, well, what are some ways that that we can connect up with Aspie. And so there I really do a lot. I play matchmaker of, okay, so you know, you're a small startup and you're looking at ways that drones can be incorporated into precision agriculture. And so what you would really like, so you are producing data, that maybe there are ways that those data can be used or analyzed by faculty or graduate students in engineering. You know, maybe what you really want to know is, well, you want someone to do kind of a deep dive into what is actually the policy and legal framework guiding the use of drones in precision ag. What can we do? What can't we do? Where are the places where technological innovations are going to bump up against the current regulatory framework? Swarming is a classic example of, you know, do we have a policy framework that allows one person to control multiple drones? So I think on the one hand, Aspie can be attractive in terms of facilitating those industry academia partnerships. And in some cases, it's about, you know, sharing data, getting better insight into the data your drones are collecting. In other cases, it's working together to secure grants and contracts and things like that. I think the other thing that we produce talent, right? So, when you think about something like Silicon Valley, there are universities known for feeding into that and feeding on that, right? So there's often this very strong relationship between these kind of innovation sites and academic institutions. And I think we can play that role in terms of producing people who come out again with that 360 view. And the design of Aspie really came from conversations with about 100 industry stakeholders that I met with as we were sort of building out the vision. And one of the stories I started hearing over and over is, okay, so we hire someone who has skills in designing drones. And it takes us about 3 years to get that person up to speed with legal. And it takes about 3 years to get that person up to speed with marketing. And then we have to do all this on-the-job training to take someone who had deep skills in one area of autonomous systems to get them to understand all the other components. And so we started thinking, well, what if we built that into a major where students are grounded, say, in mechanical engineering?
Right.
But they're also taking courses in transportation policy, and they're also taking courses in public perceptions and impacts on marginalized communities. And so they come out with those skills.
And that's been the trend generally, especially at graduate level education for a while now. I mean, I remember, you know, when I went to law school, you know, I think a lot of schools were really getting serious about doing the dual degrees.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had... I went to NYU for law school, and we had situations where I guess you could take a certain number of classes at Columbia. Columbia kids could take a certain number of classes with us, and you know, nobody ever did because nobody liked each other anyway. But but you could, right? The theory, and you could go, you know, and then what was more common is, like, you know, people would take, you know, they'd be in law school, they would take classes at the business school.
I took several
classes in the urban planning school. Yep. You know, that sort of thing, because we had the Furman Center.
And so we want to build that kind of holistic view into our students' training, because again, our goal is to put out the next generation of leaders in this emerging field that has yet to be named.
Interesting. So I always ask a couple of, like, very general questions, and you may be the most specialized guest that I've had yet. I think it's really cool because I'm fascinated by this conversation, and it's completely different than any other conversation I've had. Well, yeah, because so most of the people that I've talked to are business owners, right?
Yeah.
So, and one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you is not because you're a business owner, you're not, but I think part of what we're trying to do here is sort of blend together people's opportunities to network within the city of Syracuse, including with the school, with the city itself. You know, David Fox talked a lot about that, about sort of when he left Syracuse. This is one of my recent guests. He talked about, you know, he left Syracuse University and kind of discovered Syracuse, the city.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on is sort of bridge the gap, and also just to talk about this stuff, because I think every time I've talked to you, like, it's like impossible to stop. But I had a couple of sort of general questions that I typically ask of everybody, and I'm really curious to what you're going to come up with here. So, if you were going to recommend three books for listeners, and one of them was about business, one of them is about personal development, and one of them can be about anything else, what would those three books be?
Wow, that's a great question. So I'm going to take a cop-out answer, which is to say, at this point, I have spent almost no time reading books, because the two topics that I research change too fast.
I understand. And as a privacy and cybersecurity attorney, I completely understand that. It is a real struggle to find books. Actually, it's sitting on my desk right now. I just got a book called California Privacy Law that doesn't have the CCPA in it. Great job, guys. Thank you. Thank you very much. That'll be $50.
So I don't know. I mean, when you ask me that question, it's a moment of horror for a faculty member, professor, because I suddenly realize that I read all the time, but I have moved away from books, largely because the things it's both in the realm of international migration and also in the realm of emerging technologies, things change so fast that by the time a book is out, unless it's a more kind of theoretical or conceptual argument, it's out of date.
So let me ask the question differently then, because I totally get that. That makes a lot of sense to me. I'm going to ask you for two things to read. The first thing is, if somebody wanted to read about developments in this field, where would they go to learn about ongoing developments in the field? Your website also is an acceptable answer.
So they should first...
You should say where that is.
They first should go to the Autonomous Systems Policy Institute website. If you just Google that phrase, it will come right up. You know, this is another good question, and we actually have a faculty member who is working on kind of a textbook model on this, because it's a gap. So there's not a good primer across autonomous systems. So the place that when I started reading in this area is the Transportation Research Board's website, the trb.org, and they compile research from all over, and all of it's related to transportation. Some of it, an increasing amount of it, is related to autonomous systems, and that is where kind of I started to get my head around information there, because there's not an academic journal on autonomous systems yet. That's our idea. Don't steal it. There are industry publications. So AUVSI has a monthly magazine/newsletter. And they talk about industry developments, of really spotlighting new companies and things like that. You can sign up for things like Drone Life is a website that will send you articles every day. There are a couple like that with autonomous vehicles as well. But it really is sort of piecing together information from a lot of sources. And then I have many motivated colleagues who constantly are sending me things as well.
Right, you have a network of people.
Yeah, we do. And then we are now starting to push that information out. And in a couple of weeks, we'll launch some new portions of our websites, one of which is resources. So we have decided that, at least in the short term, we are going to put up a page that says, obviously, you should look at all the stuff on our website, but if you want to know more, here are the other universities looking at this. Here are places where you can go and read industry reports, research, because it's just not there. So we're thinking of that side as kind of a clearinghouse of where people can go.
Very cool. So we've got that covered. And the other book or reading material for any other purpose. So it could be fiction, could be, nonfiction, biography, personal development, whatever.
Another book.
The person parking outside wants to know right away.
So in this area, I would think of something like an Isaac Asimov novel. Sort of a precursor, as somebody who was thinking about where things might be going.
That's really interesting, because I've got a couple of Audible credits kicking around.
Yeah.
And I know that stuff is out there. That's a really interesting idea. Okay. And so one of the other questions that I usually ask is it's about leadership.
Ah,
right?
Yes.
And you're in a different leadership role than I am, and that a lot of entrepreneurs mm-hmm. are, but you're in a leadership role nonetheless, mm-hmm. right? You've got, and we talked about herding cats and some of those problems. So, what do you think makes for an effective leader?
I actually spend a lot of time thinking about what makes an effective leader. I think a couple of things. I think an effective leader takes the blame when things go wrong and owns it, but does not try to take the credit when things go well. So I think that is a skill of an effective leader. I think the other really important skill, in addition to being visionary, is understanding how to build capacity among the people that you work with. So whether it's clients or it's your team, or in my case it's faculty and students, it's figuring out how do you build capacity among them. How do you find ways to ensure that the people you are working with can be successful at whatever they're trying to do? And so for us, we've spent the last year trying to think about, of the 140 or so faculty who have some connection to ASPE, how do we enable them to identify one another, find shared interest, and work together on bigger projects? And COVID, of course, made that much, much more challenging, and we moved it completely to a virtual realm. But how do we actually go about building that capacity, and how do you do it in a way that doesn't always involve you?
Right.
If you as the leader are always the catalyst, you're just going to burn out. So how do you build that capacity in such a way that it enables the people you work with to do amazing things that you don't always have to be kind of the cheerleader for?
Right. Decentralized command.
Yeah. There you go. So what does that look like, and how do you do it? How do you sustain it? What kind of support does it need?
Yeah, that's like the big trust fall for leaders, right?
Yeah.
It's so hard to let go. It's so hard to say everything is my fault, and also I'm going to trust you to do it right.
Yeah. It is.
But it's doable. It's just difficult.
Yeah. And for what I'm doing, it's also asking a lot of faculty to pivot. So I have a colleague in geography, Jane Reed, who is trained as an environmental scientist. She had built her entire career around remote sensing, land use change, teaching and studying GIS. And when SU started to develop an interest in autonomous systems, Jane pivoted, right? And so she started to develop this whole research trajectory around autonomous systems, especially UAVs, and thinking about how do you get young, especially young girls and young students of color, excited about this technology in an effort to sort of expand the pipeline and the pathway of who's going into these careers. So she was on one trajectory and just turned and developed a whole new set of skills to do this. And when you have a brand new technology like that in a university, you're asking a lot of faculty to really stretch.
Yeah.
So how do you support them in doing that? How do you encourage them? How do you make it worth their while to develop this whole new research agenda around this topic that has emerged since most of us were in graduate school? So it was just not on the radar when we were trained. So how do you encourage that?
Right. So last question. Who should I interview next?
So there are a number of folks. So Jane Reed would be very interesting to talk to. She's a faculty member who's got this really strong interest in emerging technology and K through 12 education. Johannes Himmelreich is a new faculty member in public administration who is turning out to be a very highly recognized expert on ethics. And so he's very interested in the ethical and philosophical questions raised by autonomous vehicles.
So she comes to a lawyer's office and tells him, you need to talk to an ethicist.
You don't have to tell him.
Real nice, Jane.
Louise Manfredi is, she's also a relatively new faculty member, and she is trained, I'm going to get this wrong, she's trained as an engineer. She works in industrial design in the School of Visual and Performing Arts. So she has this very interdisciplinary background around, and she's interested in the design aspects and the user experience of autonomous vehicles.
How about somebody that's outside of the academic area?
Somebody outside.
Like maybe somebody working in this space.
So have you talked to some local people here? Like in the drone?
Not really, no.
So Andy Maxwell, do you know Andy Maxwell's name? So he is at SR, I think he's now at SRC. He's very interested in sort of the drone economy. Mike Herzendorf, who's the executive director of New Air, would be someone you could also talk with. We have an SU alum who does really interesting work in AVs. She bases out of Pittsburgh. Her name is Zanna Bailey.
All right.
She combined, I want to say it was engineering and international relations. And she now is at one of the big startups, which was just
so she's into building bridges.
Yeah. She epitomizes what we want to build into the curricular components that we'll do.
Cool.
All of them would be. Brian Gerling.
Brian and I.
Now this conversation is completely.
Yeah, I got to call Brian before I start going to talk to his client. That's like a no-no in lawyer world.
Yeah, he was.
I could have both of them on, though, honestly. I mean,
yeah.
That's not a terrible idea.
Right. Those would be some.
Okay. Hey, thanks so much for your time and for your help in understanding this stuff. And I'm looking forward to the post end of days.
I am too.
Conferences and we can have meetings and all that stuff. I'm looking forward to seeing what the Institute comes up with.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me.
It was a pleasure. Like I said, every time we talk, I learn something, and I'm glad we did.
Cool. Well, this was really fun.
Cool. Thanks so much.